Thanks for listening to the History Buff podcast with your resident history buff and Berlin tour guide, Arty. If you're enjoying the podcast and would like to see more History Buff content, then please do give us a follow on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube. Links are in the show notes. Thank you so much for your support. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode on a fascinating figure in history, Josip Broz Tito. For this episode, which will be a discussion, I am joined by Igor Radulovic, a fellow history buff who is a historian and history teacher from Montenegro, who is living and working in the Netherlands. Igor is passionate about contemporary history, especially the breakup with Yugoslavia, very relevant in this episode. He even collaborates with the UN International Residual Mechanism for Criminal Tribunals on a project related to facts established by the ICTY and the mechanism regarding the crimes committed in the 1990s conflicts in Yugoslavia. I will add the link to this project in the show notes, so please do take a look at this. Right, so welcome, Igor.
Thank you, Arthur, and thank you for inviting me and, of course, mentioning the project that I'm working on, but also my interest in the similar topics, such as, of course, the topic of Josip Broz Tito and his importance in former Yugoslavia, especially, I would say.
Wonderful. Great to have you on here. So I guess let's go back to the beginning. So Josip Broz, as he was born then, because he was just born Josip Broz, wasn't he?
Yes, that's correct.
Was born to a Croatian Slovene peasant family in Krumovec. Am I butchering that?
Krumovec, that's how we say it, yeah.
Right, okay, thank you. A village in the Kingdom of Croatia, Slavonia, which was a part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire at the time. And so, yes, his name was originally just Josip Broz. And I'm right in thinking the name Tito was a pseudonym that he started using during his revolutionary activities. Would you like to tell us a little bit about his early life, please, Igor?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you said, he was born as Josip Broz, and he was born in 1892. So Krumovec is a small village, which I actually have visited, I think, 5 or 6 years ago. And basically, although it's in today's Croatia, it was a part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire at the time. It was a poor family in, I would say, undeveloped part of the Austro-Hungarian Hungary. So definitely his childhood was not an easy one. We don't have enough, I would say, information about that period of time. But what we know that he attended definitely the primary school in his village. And he finished his primary school somewhere around 1905, which is obviously when he was around the age of 13. So usually in those places, the kids would go to a trade afterwards. But because of this kind of difficult situation that he had in his family, instead of doing that, he went to work with his uncle in Slovenia. So as you said, his mother was from Slovenia, his dad was from Croatia, today's Slovenian Croatia, of course. And therefore, he actually had to, I would even say, to work at that early age for a couple of years. I think that he even spent like 3 or 4 years with his uncle. And then he came back to Croatia. And he even visited Zagreb for the first time in 1910, so when he was around 18, I would say. Already at the time, he even joined one of the political parties that existed in Croatia. It was, well, I think the proper translation would be the Social Democratic Party of Croatian Slavonia. It's a long name. Even at the time, he started participating in some of the demonstration, like labor demonstration in that region. And then afterwards, because of his financial situation, I would say mostly he had to move and he even worked across the Austro-Hungarian Empire.
And what was he mostly working as? It was a locksmith.
He's mostly known as a locksmith, but he was doing like different type of jobs. I know that, for example,
jack of all trades, we would say in English.
Yeah. I think that even in Germany, he was working for a while as a test driver for one of the companies. I'm not sure which one exactly, honestly. But as I said, as he was traveling and working across the Austro-Hungarian Empire in general, he was even able to learn different languages. So, for example, he was pretty fluent in German, even Czech. You will see later that, of course, he even learned Russian. And it's interesting that a lot of, I wouldn't say historians, but a lot of people in general are talking about Tito as a spy. Mostly because he spoke so many languages and like people would say, oh, actually, he was not Yugoslav or Croatian or Slovenia or whatever. He was actually a German or even British or the Austro-Hungarian intelligence officer.
Right. Okay. And so, and obviously his sort of socialist background comes about from, you know, obviously being a worker, working obviously in these different fields. So that's what, you know, when he gets, starts to become engaged with the worker and labor movements. And as you say, joining the Social Democratic Party. And obviously it's important to stress to everyone listening at the moment that the state of Yugoslavia does not exist by this point.
Okay. Absolutely. And thank you for mentioning that, because at the time, most of the people who were considered as Yugoslavs lived under Austro-Hungarian Empire. So most of the people in today's, let's say, Slovenia, Croatia, Bosnia and Herzegovina, even part of today's Montenegro. So those were all parts of the Austro-Hungarian Empire.
And Serbia, am I right in thinking, was the only one that was its own country?
Serbia and Montenegro as well.
I mean, I'm Montenegro, right.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Okay. And then so Tito's military career then obviously begins in 1913. So he enlists in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which obviously rules over the what would become most of what would become Yugoslavia. And I think his decision to join the military was partly influenced by the economic hardship faced by his family. Is that right?
Yeah, because he basically joined the army, which is interesting, a year before World War I started.
Exactly.
So he joined the army in 1913, right? So he was, what, 21 at the time. And as you said, he didn't have many choices. So he decided to join the army. But of course, what he could not predict, obviously, that the war will start in less than a year. So when the war started, right, after the Sarajevo assassination and all the things that happened in June and July of 1914, he was, of course, enlisted in the Austro-Hungarian army. And he was even sent to the front practically at the beginning of the war. But during these struggles, I would say, during the war on the campaigns, he was even wounded. So in May of 1915. And
during the Brusilov offensive, wasn't it?
I think so. Sure, but I think so, because it's 1915, so it's kind of logical. So what's important to stress out now is that he was wounded and he was captured by the Russians at the time. And he was even sent to a Russian hospital where he spent the next 13 months. So during that time, he learned a lot about the ideas of revolution, because he was in Russia during the 1917, which, of course, is important to mention, because we have both the February and the October Revolution. So even after he left the hospital, even afterwards, as I said, he stayed in Russia and he got familiar with the ideas of revolution, which of course, and of, I would say, of communism as well, which were aligned already with some of his attitudes. But we definitely must stress out now that he definitely developed those ideas furthermore.
Okay, so then after the October Revolution in 1917, Tito is released as part of general amnesty for prisoners of war, and he returns to what is by that point Yugoslavia. Oh, well, it's the Kingdom of, what is it called?
Yeah, so that's interesting. Officially, the name of the country was Kingdom of Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. So we're not quite at Yugoslavia just yet. Apologies. Mm. So basically, he goes back to his homeland. So after the war ends in November 1918, the Kingdom of Serbia, the state of Slovenes, Croats, and Serbs, and the Kingdom of Montenegro, is that
Montenegro?
It?
Montenegro, yeah.
So that was formed on the 1st of December 1918.
Yeah.
With the collapse of the Austrian Empire, obviously. Cool. So then that leads to the Kingdom of Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes. And it starts out life as a constitutional monarchy.
Yes, it does start its life as a constitutional monarchy, but that was only in theory. We can actually see from historical documents and in general from the public opinion, that country was definitely not following the path that was established after World War I ended and after the country was proclaimed. So the role of the monarch was extremely high, and also the role
of political power.
Absolutely. And he was supported by the strongest political parties in the country. Mm-hmm. And usually you had like two major political parties in the country that would form a coalition, that would form a government, and of course, that would align with King's attitude. And therefore, everyone who was against it, including the communists, as we will see, were neglected or even forcefully removed from the political life of the country.
Ah, okay. So it was essentially a sort of monarchical dictatorship.
Absolutely. So as we know, in between World War One and World War Two, there are too many authoritarian regimes in Europe. And one of them at the time definitely was the one in Yugoslavia.
Right. Okay. Obviously, in the early kingdom, efforts were made to sort of centralize power, but it faced resistance from certain groups. And as we said, it was basically a royal dictatorship. So the first king was King Peter the First. And then you had...
Actually, it was Alexander, his son.
Oh, Alexander. Okay.
Yeah,
So King Peter wasn't actually king at any point.
No. He was king of Serbia during the war.
Right, that's it.
But when the country was... When country was unified, he actually kind of gave that role to his son because he was younger and everything.
When exactly was it unified?
So officially, December 1st, 1918. Everything was proclaimed as such.
Okay. Yeah. So it's held together. It's fairly fracturous. And all during this time, this kind of fairly fracturous royal dictatorship, trying to hold this diverse state together. You have Tito, who is back in his homeland, and was he a founding member of the Communist Party of Yugoslavia?
He joined the party. The party was already established.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So he joins the Communist Party of Yugoslavia. So as you can see, the idea of Yugoslavia is already there.
Absolutely.
Okay, and how long did it take for Tito to rise through the ranks?
I would say, he kind of needed time, but it was influenced by the political situation.
Because the Communist Party was repressed by the political regime.
Yes. But let's just have in mind that in 1920, there were elections in the country.
Were they free and fair?
Yes and no. I cannot say that they were fully free, but at least people had a chance to express their view mostly. I would say the biggest problem for those elections was that majority of the population was illiterate. And therefore, there was a lot of space for manipulation.
Yeah, made it hard to engage.
Yeah.
So the CPY, the Communist Party of Yugoslavia, during this time engages with the Yugoslav national question, which in itself addresses the issues of ethnic and religious diversity within the kingdom, which I think obviously shows that it was always the Communist Party's or Tito's. I don't know how far you can separate the two, really. It was always their intention to try and make these differences as small as possible because they knew that that was the only way they were going to unify the state.
Absolutely, absolutely. And as you asked me before about like Tito's role and everything, in the 1920s, his role was not that big because after the party was banned and everything, he even moved out of Zagreb where he was living since 1920. But he came back there in 1927. Which is important because he started kind of propagating the ideas of communism once again. But because of that, he ended up in prison because party was, of course, as we said, banned. You cannot make any propaganda related to communism in the country. And that's why he was arrested in 1928 and he even had to spend 5 years in prison.
Yes. And he was building a united front against the monarchy, against fascism, and basically sort of portraying it as a common struggle of the southern Slavic peoples.
Absolutely.
And I think that's partly why he was prisoned, is because it was becoming quite effective.
Yeah, at the time, definitely. Yeah. Also with the economic situation in the country and many other things as well, definitely.
Yeah, exactly. So, however, during the interwar period, the CPY faced internal divisions. So there were obviously debates within the Comintern, which is the Communist International, over the best approach to revolutionary activities in Yugoslavia. I mean, we'll talk a little bit later about the actual form of communism that Tito implements in Yugoslavia. Obviously, the one that people most know about in the Eastern Bloc states is Marxism-Leninism, which was the ideas of Marx as interpreted by Lenin. But we'll talk more about that a little bit later. So, in 1929, King Alexander I establishes a royal dictatorship in an attempt to centralize power and curb ethnic divisions, but this move is obviously met with a lot of resistance. And so at this point, Tito and other leaders are engaged in acts of resistance against the royal dictatorship, which obviously then leads to increased repression at the time.
Yeah, definitely. And we even had a lot of examples where the members of, where the supporters of communists, let's say like that, were, as we said, imprisoned as the example of Tito. So in a way, luckily for Tito, he was in prison at the time until 1934. So he wasn't that much involved in these things. And I would say that he probably would be even in danger. His life would be in danger if he had to participate in those things. But after he went out, after 1934, I would say that his role in the party was way bigger. Of course, although we said the Communist Party did not exist, like although it was banned, they were still functioning kind of underground. So they still were trying, of course, to develop their ideas furthermore. Right. And even the importance for, I mean, Tito himself was so important at the time that in 1937, he even became the General Secretary of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of Yugoslavia.
Which in Communist Party is the leader.
That's it. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah,
that's
reached the top.
Yeah.
Okay, so he reached that in 1937. And then obviously 2 years later, the Second World War starts. So would you like to just give a sort of brief bit of context in the sort of what happened to Yugoslavia through the Second World War?
Yeah. So I think it's also important to mention that although World War II started in 1939, of course, with the things that happened in Poland, etc., Yugoslavia was not officially involved in war until 1941.
Right.
So, of course, at the time, there were a lot of even debates in Yugoslavia what kind of the official political stance should be towards not only World War II, but also towards the whole situation. Of course, Tito, at the time, as a member of the Communist Party, even traveled to Soviet Union even before war. So even in 1938 and 1939, especially. But the situation in country in Yugoslavia was not great. And because, as we know, Germany, the Nazi Germany, kind of was spreading, especially in 1941, Yugoslavian government was challenged by the Nazis. And literally, they had to either...
But wait, hang on a minute. When you say Yugoslavia, you still mean the Kingdom of Serbs, Croats and...
No. It's Kingdom of Yugoslavia from 1929.
Officially,
it's Kingdom of Yugoslavia. Yeah.
Okay, right. Cool, thanks.
And it's interesting that even the government that was established in 1939...
So that was the dictatorship that was established by King Alexander.
Cool. But later, he introduced some constitution. He kind of gave the constitution to the country. So like the dictatorship was not so strong anymore. Mm-hmm. And Alexander also died in the meanwhile. That's important to stress out. He died in 1934 in Marseille, in France. He was murdered by actually an extreme terrorist group from Yugoslavia. So it was kind of a bond between Ustashas from Croatia and the Macedonian terrorists. So they killed him because they were not satisfied with how the country was governed. And after his death, usually what has happened that because his son was young, he was underage, we have the establishment of these governments. Then Uncle Pavle, that was his name, was kind of regent, but I wouldn't say that his influence was so huge. So country, to put it like this, was in a mess.
And obviously Tito comes to the forefront here by playing a key role in organizing the partisans.
Yeah.
So that's a resistant movement.
Even organizing the demonstration. The communists were actually the ones who organized the demonstration against the signing of the pact with the Nazis and the others. Okay. So that's why they were even forced to repel that document, to remove it.
Okay. And so Tito convenes the first session of the Anti-Fascist Council for the National Liberation of Yugoslavia, abbreviated the AVNOJ.
Yeah.
And so that lays the groundwork for a united front against fascism. So this obviously then basically forms the basis of what Tito will be doing over the course of the war. So would you like to tell us a little bit about what he was actually doing during the war?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that that's really important and interesting to mention. So when the war in Yugoslavia started in 1941, he was in Zagreb, but he decided soon to move to Belgrade because he knew that that's the place where he should start the preparation for the uprising. And bear in mind that the uprising in Yugoslavia was actually the biggest one in whole Europe. So it can be only compared later to, I don't know, the Polish one and the resistance in France. But there is another pretty complicated story in here is that at the beginning of the war, you basically had two major factions in the country who were resisting the occupation of the Axis powers. So on one side, of course, you had partisans, as you said, that were led by Josip Broz Tito. And on the other side, you had the royalists who were kind of pro-heavily who were heavily pro-Serbs, and they were led by Draža Mihailović. And they're mostly known, I would say, around the world as Chetniks, because the word comes from the word that means armed band. So at the beginning, let's say, so May, June 1941, both movements were fighting against the Axis. And they even tried to resist the occupying German forces together. And they even had a meeting. Which also happened in 1941. And the point of the meeting was to unite forces. But that failed. And it failed mostly because the leader of Chetniks, Draža Mihailović, was not supportive of Tito's ideas. Mm-hmm. So obviously, because Tito had this whole idea of Yugoslav unity, right?
And that's everyone... what he was emphasizing, right? He wanted to emphasize the unity among ethnic and political groups. And so really, this kind of actually forms the foundations of what would later become his politics.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's, I think, eventually why so many people during the war supported him. Not only the people who were communists, right, through their ideals, but also the people who realized and who noticed that the fight that Tito and the communists are leading, the partisans actually, is the real fight against the Axis powers. Why I'm saying this? Because Chetniks, later on during the war, actually started collaborating, especially with the Germans. Because for them, in one moment, it was more important to fight against the partisans, to remove them as internal opponents, than to fight against the Germans. And that's what the Allies also realized. So at the beginning of the war, allies, especially Great Britain, supported Chetniks, supported Draža Mihailović, especially because the Yugoslav government with the king was in exile in London.
It's important to stress that also, he was the leader at this time, the leader of the partisans.
Absolutely.
But it's, I think, fair to say that he was a pretty effective leader because his leadership was instrumental in the Battle of Sutjeska.
That's how we pronounce it.
In 1943. And he had a successful evacuation of partisan forces, including wounded soldiers and civilians through difficult mountain terrain. And so that was very, very well.
That's after the Battle of Neretva, one of the biggest battle of World War II in Yugoslavia.
And also Tito had a narrow escape during a German air raid.
Ondervar.
And so that obviously shows, you know, the constant threat he faced. So he was obviously incredibly good under pressure.
He had to be, unfortunately. Yes. I mean, that was the case.
Totally. And he obviously then, as you say, eventually received Allied support. But as you say, it came quite late towards the end of the war. So towards the end of the war in 1944, you have the Belgrade Offensive. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, well, in the second half of the 1944, most of the country was deliberated, including, as you said, Belgrade. It is interesting to say, of course, that it was mostly the effort of the partisans who, as I said, fought against the Germans since 1941. And they even started deliberating small portions of territory even during 41, 42, and of course, 43. So, for example, in 41, a small part in today's Serbia around the city of Užice was liberated. They even managed to establish the so-called Republic of Užice. Later, they mostly moved to Bosnia, and that's why you mentioned Abnoj, that's how we say it. That's where most of these important sessions were held, where they've decided what the future of the country should be after the war.
And sorry, also, before we go any further, we just to make it clear, they're liberating themselves from the Nazis, right?
Yes.
So Yugoslavia had been fully occupied by the Nazis since when?
Since May of 1941.
Okay, right.
Yeah. Of course, part of the country was under the Italian regime, I would say, until 1943, of course, when they capitulated. But I'm just mentioning this with a reason. So the communist partisans practically fought on their own until 1944. We know that the situation in general in Europe has changed after the D-Day and after, of course, all major campaigns that both the Anglo-American, but also, of course, the Soviet troops started in 1943 and 1944, as we mentioned. And that, of course, made, in a way, the partisan fight in Yugoslavia a bit easier in 1944.
But so they liberated themselves. They didn't really have much.
Most of the territory, Well, with Belgrade, for example, it's a bit different because at the time, the Soviets were already there. So the Soviets helped in that phase. But I definitely must stress out that kind of the Yugoslav partisans already kind of cleared the path, definitely, for them. And it was much easier to finish that kind of whole episode and that whole part of the war.
Okay, And so then once the Nazis are vanquished and have been pushed out of Yugoslavia, you have a victory parade in Belgrade on the 15th of May, 1945. And that's obviously led by Tito. And that obviously marks the official end of the Second World War in Yugoslavia. And celebrated the triumph of the partisan forces and obviously by extension, Tito. So Tito is obviously in prime position to take control in Yugoslavia, obviously. So first thing that happens, obviously, is a general election. So do you want to talk us through a bit of a background about the 1945 general election?
Yeah, I will just make also a kind of a short introduction related to the situation in Yugoslavia before the elections. So let's just bear in mind that Yugoslavia was one of the countries that was literally devastated during the war. So millions of people died, the whole infrastructure was destroyed, and therefore, of course, like, well, let's say rest of Europe, they faced huge difficulties in reconstructing the country in general. Mm-hmm. And it was a chaos. And it was really hard to kind of establish anything. But how the country would look like after 1945, after the war, if we want to answer that question, we can basically use one name, and that's Tito. He was the one that basically dictated everything, and he was the one who made all the important choices.
But is he the one who called the election?
Among the other things, yeah. So the first thing is that during the war, there were even some agreements that were made with the royalists in London, with the government that was there, to do certain things together. But of course, when the war ended and when the partisans contributed the most to the victory, the things have changed. So the first elections were held right after the war. So just a couple of months after the war ended. Although everyone was allowed to vote, there were some restrictions. Especially those restrictions were applied to those who were compromised during the war, who were compromising the national liberation struggle and the principles of revolution. So let's say that the supporters of Chetniks were discouraged from voting, or in a way they were even disabled. So the law was there, it was enacted, it was introduced, but there were some limitations, which at the time, taking the situation into account, was, I would say, even normal, right? Because, well, let's bear in mind that the war ended just a half a year ago, that million point something, 0.3 or 0.2, depending on the data, people died, that partisans kind of did everything practically on their own. So that's how kind of everything was organized. And it's interesting that there was another list, like the opposition, which had no formal name, because it was also hard to make an opposition to the people's front, to the people who obviously fought in the war, who contributed the most to the victory. And it was hard to say, okay, they are the people's front and we are what? What is our kind of status? What is our opinion on stuff? So they participated in the elections. But of course, as you can imagine, the people's front won most of the votes, if I recall correctly, 90.48 or something like that. So definitely more than 90% of the voters, while the opposition had less than 10%.
Okay, so the general election took place on the 11th of November, 1945. Yes. And I mean, personally, I think I can see why the leftist forces won so much, and it's because they were there. They were there during the war. Yeah. They were the ones fighting, whereas, you know, obviously the royalists and people who wanted the previous regime, they were in exile in London, sitting comfortably in London. So I, you know, I totally, to be honest, understand why they got such a landslide. Is there sort of people who question whether it was free and fair?
Well, yes, but of course, those who questioned it didn't end up well. Most of them,
okay,
of course, were in prisons or were even removed in a different way. So it was not easy to be an opposition to the People's Front at the time, definitely.
Okay, so by this point, Tito is prime minister.
Yeah, let's say from today's perspective, he can be regarded as a prime minister. Because in Avno, in 1943, on the second session, he was proclaimed as the leader. So,
Head of the presidium of something.
Yeah, it's really complex to explain it.
Yeah, communist leaders were always multiple titles and multiple different things. It was always basically just leader, So, the CPY obviously emerges victorious in the election. And, you know, even though it was, you know, a multi-party election, the political landscape was characterized by the dominance of the People's Front and the CPY. So following the election, the Federal People's Republic of Yugoslavia was officially proclaimed on the 29th of November, 1945. So, I mean, I'm guessing that's what they campaigned on, saying, if you vote for us, we are going to form this state. And so this marked the beginning of socialist rule under Tito. So yeah, let's for now say that he is prime minister and later becomes president of the Presidium of the National Assembly. That's it.
Yes.
On the 13th of January, 1953. So consolidating his power as country's leader. So the political system established was a one-party system dominated by the CPY, which became the League of Communists of Yugoslavia, the LCY, in 1952. In the years following the election, Tito and the communist leadership initiated a process of socialist transformation. And so that obviously involved nationalization of industry, land reforms, and the establishment of a planned economy. However, it's important to remember, as I alluded to earlier, Tito's brand of communism wasn't quite the same as the communist implemented in the Eastern Bloc states.
Absolutely.
For example, I don't think that there was quite as much land reform. Like, for example, did they have collectivization of agriculture?
I would kind of like to elaborate on that a bit more, okay, because it's interesting to compare it definitely, first of all, with the Soviet Union, mm-hmm, but also to explain certain things that you mentioned right now. So later on, we will reflect on how Tito broke with Stalin, how he didn't align with him, how he even had a, I would say, a quarrel with him.
Yeah.
But we cannot say that he break with the principles or the methods of the communist rule.
Yeah. So certainly starting after the war, he had a good relationship with the
Absolutely. Soviet. Yeah. So there was a huge difference between Yugoslavia as a communist state and Soviet Union and any other communist state in Europe at the time, because Yugoslavia was ruled through a policy that they referred to as self-management. Mm-hmm. What is that? So it meant that decision-making in the country could be taken away from the political center, from the centralized government, right? And it can be given to the workers' councils, which in a way is similar to what we had in Soviet Union after the October Revolution, when we had those original Soviets, right?
Right. So, yeah, the socialist revolutionaries.
Yeah. So basically, yeah, country was controlled by the Communist Party, of course, but there was still some autonomy. So yes, the worker councils were the ones who were making certain decisions in their company, who were kind of course, supporting the rise of industry, the development of the economy and development of the country as well. And also have in mind that country that was formed after World War II, Yugoslavia, the new Yugoslavia, the second Yugoslavia, as we call it as well, was actually a federation of six republics.
Yes.
So, and all those republics, so just to mention them, Serbia, Croatia, Slovenia, Bosnia and Herzegovina, Montenegro, and Macedonia, they were equal. So they were regarded as equal. Of course, there were certain differences in terms of size, in terms of population, etc. But all of these republics, they had kind of also individual role in that self-management process.
Okay, so it wasn't hyper-centralized.
Absolutely not. It was definitely more, I would even say, liberal than
any other. And the capital was Belgrade.
Yeah, right. Yeah, definitely.
Okay, that's very interesting to know. So obviously, yeah, we're talking about the good points of Tito here because, so obviously the first good point has got to be that Tito was, you know, he led the charge against fascism. And, you know, head of the partisans, you know, head of a multi-ethnic and multi-religious resistance movement and, you know, resisting Axis occupation and playing a crucial role in the liberation of Yugoslavia. So, I mean, I think in many people's eyes, he's got to be, you know, a hero, at least just for that. But then, of course, what we've just been alluding to, he was really the unifying force of Yugoslavia. So he played a key role in the establishment of the Socialist Federal Republic of Yugoslavia. So unifying various ethnic groups and regions under a federal structure, as we've just alluded to after the Second World War. And he wanted to make sure that people focus more on Yugoslavia, not their regions' identities.
Yeah.
I think what we could say he is most known for is his very clever non-alignment policy. So do you want to sort of give us a little bit of background about his non-alignment policy?
Yeah. So I think it's important to mention, first of all, that as we all, I assume, know, after World War II, we basically have two blocks in the world, right? So the Warsaw Pact and NATO, or to be more precise, yeah, the communist states, yes. And of course, on the other side, the more liberal states, the Catholic states, yeah, led by the United States, of course. Yeah. definitely Tito had a clever policy after the wall, and he didn't officially align with neither of them. So
obviously, him being Yugoslavia being a communist state, people obviously probably expected him. Well, no more so than the Soviets and Stalin himself. No, you know, expected him to align with them.
Yeah, of course. But it's important to mention that although Yugoslavia was a communist state, right? He also, like Tito and the country, had a lot of economic support from the West. And he knew that he fully supports the Eastern Bloc, as you said. He will lose that, first of all, economic support from the United States and exactly. from the Western countries in general. And that's why he officially never supported them. And he wanted to make...
That's why he was so clever. That's absolutely. Why he basically used each side for his own advantage.
Yeah.
By not aligning with either side, which is genius, I think.
Yeah. As we call it here, he decided to go with the third way. So,
but what's crazy is that, you know, you have so many pictures of him being the sort of statesman, you know, meeting with, you know, Churchill, meeting with
Queen Elizabeth,
meeting all of these American presidents, you know, and also Soviet leaders. So, you know, that shows very much just how much he was, you know, in the middle, this third way, as you're talking about.
Yeah.
But obviously, his third way leads to tension with Soviet leader Joseph Stalin, who obviously thinks that, you know, probably from the help that the Soviets gave Yugoslavia, the fact that it's a communist country, that it belongs in the Eastern Bloc and belongs in Moscow's, wants it to be in Moscow's sphere of influence. Yeah. So this actually leads to no fewer than 5 attempts on Tito's life.
At least five.
Yeah, I think there might be more.
As always, anyway. There are different versions. Some are saying even about more than 20 of them, which is crazy.
Yeah, exactly. So 5 official that we know of attempts on Tito's life ordered by Stalin, all of which fail. And Tito gets so fed up with this that he writes Stalin a letter.
Yes.
And he says, "Stop sending people to kill me. We've already captured 5 of them, 1 of them with a bomb and another with a rifle. If you don't stop sending killers, I'll send 1 to Moscow and I won't have to send another."
Yeah.
That was history's greatest mic drop moment.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's, you know, a lot of people are doubting whether this happened or not, whether this is a real version, but actually it is. He literally has sent that letter to him because he obviously was fed up with all of these attempts and he literally just said, "Stop it. You cannot kill me, obviously. So let's not move on with this and let's pretend as it didn't happen because I will react on my own way." And I'm pretty much sure that maybe he would even try it. So like knowing Tito from historical perspective, knowing all the things that he has done, and just I will add, for example, you mentioned him meeting the American presidents. I don't know whether you're aware of it, but he's the only person that ever had a cigar in the White House. And there is even a photo of him sitting with the American president. He actually had a Cuban cigar. And just imagine Tito smoking a Cuban cigar in the White House during the Cold War.
I know.
Right after the Cuban crisis. I mean, it's crazy. So I would also kind of encourage other people to look for it and just take a look at that photo. Because it also, as you said, from a micro-historical perspective, it shows a lot.
Yeah. So he was a statesman. He was very good at playing both sides of the Cold War, the West and the Eastern blocs, off against each other for his own advantage. And obviously, he didn't have to worry about Stalin for that long because in 1953, Stalin dies. And I'm guessing after that, he has a slightly better relationship with Khrushchev.
Absolutely. Yeah. Even Khrushchev visited Belgrade and Tito also visited Moscow, I think, like a year later afterwards. But it was also symbolic that actually, if I recall correctly, Khrushchev was the first one that actually visited Tito, and then Tito kind of returned the favor. Right. We can say it like that. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So, yeah. Well, he obviously becomes a fairly respected figure, but domestically in Yugoslavia, so Yugoslavia experiences periods of economic growth, industrialization, improving standards of living, and the country's self-management system allowed workers a degree of decision-making, as we were talking about earlier with the workers' councils. And Tito implemented policies aimed at fostering national unity that we've talked about a lot. So the Brotherhood of Unity, and, you know, sought to create above any region a Yugoslav identity, essentially. It's sort of because of this that during the Cold War, Yugoslavia maintained relative stability. And, you know, I guess that was, you know, a direct consequence of, you know, the non-alignment. But also, referring back to what we were saying earlier about Tito's more liberal brand of socialism or communism, this involved a couple of things. So we're going to come on to Tito's negative point soon, because obviously he, at the end of the day, he was a dictator, and that, absolutely, you know, being a dictator, you know, comes with a lot of very big downsides, and a lot of people didn't like him. It's important to stress that. But he did allow a degree of press freedom. So there was a diversity of media outlets. So Yugoslavia had a more diverse media landscape compared to the Eastern Blocs. So there were multiple newspapers, magazines, and broadcast outlets that represented different political and cultural perspectives. Also, what he allowed was cultural and artistic freedom.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's really important to stress out. And as I said before, although there were like some bands kind of were promoting this idea of brotherhood and unity, especially the band that I mentioned, we actually need to mention that Yugoslavia was also a country where some Western form of art kind of influenced the population even at the time when they've happened. So let's say rock and roll as an idea, right, that started in Britain and spread in the United States or vice versa, it doesn't matter, was already there in Yugoslavia in the 1960s. We have the whole punk movement in the 1970s, like post-punk movement in the 1980s. I know that Deep Purple was playing in Yugoslavia in the 1970s, and some bands that definitely were not known, let's say, in the Soviet Union.
It's important to stress it wasn't a totally free press.
Absolutely not. And it's impossible. Come on. Even in the liberal societies at the time, you didn't have it. Exactly. And not in a communist
but
state.
He also, you know, he had a cautious approach to repression. So, you know, he's definitely not in the same league as Stalin and Hitler.
Doesn't excuse the fact that not to be compared.
Yeah. Doesn't obviously excuse the fact that he was a dictator who, you know, did still repress dissent, which we will talk about in just a sec. But also, you were allowed to leave Yugoslavia also as well. You know, you weren't a prisoner within the borders like you were in most Eastern Bloc states. So, you know, that obviously is a major difference to, let's say, the Marxist-Leninist states. So, you know, these are all reasons why I think Tito is remembered fondly, because, you know, he did communism in his own way, in a more liberal way, and in a way that, you know, fostered economic growth, you know, a Yugoslav identity, which I think a lot of people really identified with, and indeed today, I think, still sort of identify with.
So, yeah, as you said, there are even still regions in ex-Yugoslavia where people are nourishing this idea of brotherhood and unity. And it's like been, what, 40-something years since Tito died, 30 years since the breakup of Yugoslavia. But there are some people who still believe in those ideals and who are still talking about those great times when they were able to earn way more, to, of course, express themselves in a certain way, maybe not as liberal as today. But they do appreciate way more what was happening in, let's say, the 1970s than what's happening now in the places they are
living. Well, and also because, you know, you didn't, like in also the Eastern Bloc states, you know, you didn't have to worry about your rent payment month to month. You know, you didn't have to worry about your utility bills. You know, the food was cheap. I mean, there wasn't a whole range of food, but the food that was available, maybe there was in Yugoslavia, but in the Eastern Bloc states, there wasn't a huge range of food. Exactly. And I mean, you know, at the end of the day, if you had a good experience under a regime, you're likely to, you know, be nostalgic about it. You know, that's absolutely obvious, really.
But it's also normal, as you said, to stress out the negatives. And
exactly,
we are not
here to say,
yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely.
So, okay. First of all, at the end of the day, it was an authoritarian rule. So while Tito maintained a sort of a facade of collective leadership, you know, he held a dominant and authoritarian position within the League of Communists of Yugoslavia. And, you know, and dissent was suppressed and political opposition was not really tolerated. So people who actually wanted Tito to be more, you know, Marxist, Leninist, be more like the Eastern Bloc states, more Stalinist, essentially. So I guess you could say more hardliners, really, wanted Tito to be more hardline. They were suppressed.
Yes, and not only them, which is the saddest thing of them all, is that you had a lot of people who did nothing, who weren't supporting Stalin, his ideas or anything, but because they were accused by the members of the Communist Party, they were sent to jail. It was, you know, literally my word against yours. I'm accusing you of being Stalinist supporter. You're trying to defend yourself, but you're not influential enough, and therefore you would be sent to the prison. And unfortunately, most of those prisons were on the islands in the Adriatic Sea, where, as I said, you know, the methods that they were using against those people were extremely cruel. And even some writers, some historians were referring to them as Mediterranean gulags. And the most infamous one was in the island of Goli Otok. It's like a bare island because there is nothing on it, like only rocks and nothing. And a lot of people actually were sent there. And unfortunately, a lot of them, and even most of them, when you look at the percentages, were from Montenegro, from the country that I'm coming from. And like around 5,000 of them were sent there. And the conditions of people who were imprisoned there and who had to work as well were terrible. Just mentioning the fact that they had to extract sand from the sea in extreme cold was one of the common ways of how they were punishing prisoners. Or they would just beat them up without a reason. Or they will, I don't know, they would send them to a hole on the island where they would have to spend like days or something like that. So that was both like physical and psychological torture, because they wanted to make them to say that they actually supported Stalin, that they supported the Soviet Union, that they supported those, as you said, hardline ideas. So yeah, that's definitely one of the darkest episodes that should be mentioned. And unfortunately,
and it's known as the Informbüro.
Informbüro.
Which went from 1948 to 1955, and obviously, and 53, and that was caused by the split with the Soviet Union. Obviously, then that is what led to Stalin trying to have him assassinated.
Yes, among the other things, of course. It's interconnected, obviously.
Okay, that's definitely very important for people to know. And also, we talked earlier about how he allowed press freedom to an extent. There was still, you know, the regime still imposed strict censorship on, you know, limiting freedom of speech and of expression. I can imagine you probably weren't allowed to, you know, deface pictures of Tito and, you know, and demonstrate against the regime openly in sort of central squares in Zagreb or in Belgrade.
There is an interesting thing, if I can mention it, sorry for interrupting you, but although, of course, you were not allowed to protest against Tito or something like that, in 1968, when, as we know, in the whole Europe, there were huge student protests. We also had them in Yugoslavia. So, for example, just to mention, there was a huge student protest by the Albanian students who were living in Pristina and studying in Pristina, actually, which at the time was the provincial capital of Kosovo. Now it's, of course, as we know, the capital of Kosovo, and that's a totally different story that could be, of course, mentioned later on. But actually, these students who were protesting were actually rewarded by the establishment of university in that city, and also with them being allowed to have the instructions in their own Albanian language. They could even, I don't know, display their flag, et cetera, et cetera. So unfortunately, some, of course, historians and some research in general see this as a downfall, as a decline of Tito's authority in a way. But he actually wanted, as we said, kind of also to decentralize certain things a bit and to, of course, give more freedom and give more rights even to the minorities in the state.
Right. And so, well, I mean, that actually almost sounds like a good thing, really.
Absolutely.
So from the bad, still there's a little bit of good. But sticking with some negative things, obviously, he wanted to suppress ethnic tensions, but obviously they did still persist and obviously erupted, obviously, after his death, which we'll talk about in just a sec. So, you know, they did still persist, but obviously they just weren't, you know, very visible. And also, despite periods of economic growth, Yugoslavia also faced economic challenges, including growing foreign debt. And what's quite funny is that Tito enjoyed wearing luxury suits. and he has very stylish sunglasses. If you look at him in pictures in the sort of 60s and 70s, he's wearing very well-tailored suits and very nice, very stylish sunglasses. So that's, you know, something that obviously probably wasn't very appropriate at a time when maybe then Yugoslavia was starting to decline economically.
But also another interesting thing is that, I don't know whether you're aware of it, but he has like a summer resort on an island called Brioni. It's in Istria, in today's Croatia, close to the city of Pula. So he had practically the whole island for himself. And I visited that island recently. And he even had his own personal zoo there.
I really hope that we have given a balanced view, because obviously there were extreme downsides to the fact that, you know, it was at the end of the day a communist dictatorship, you know, and people did still have freedom suppressed. However, I think on balance, really, personally, what I will say I will take away from it is that actually he was a pretty liberal, he was a communist dictator, but a pretty liberal communist dictator. certainly compared to Stalin and Brezhnev and all of those sort of, and Honecker and, you know, all of these sort of...
Ceausescu or anyone who like was...
Exactly.
Yeah, definitely.
Now let's talk about the end of his life. Do you have anything else you want to add before we go to that?
No, I think we have covered a lot of things. So yeah.
Cool. Okay. So towards the end of the 1970s, so he's been in power now for almost 30 years. Because when did he actually come in power, get into power?
Well, I mean, officially we can even say 1943, but let's say 1945 when the war ended, then after the elections and the new constitution.
Right.
So officially, let's say that he ruled Yugoslavia from 1945 to 1918.
In a certain capacity, he has ruled since 1945. Okay.
Yeah.
So after 30 years of ruling Yugoslavia, in the mid-1970s, his health starts to decline and he'd undergone several major surgeries. And in the late 1970s, there were obviously increasing concerns about his ability to lead the country effectively. And if I'm right in thinking, that's because he started to develop dementia.
Among the other things, yeah. He was 80-something already. So yes.
Exactly. So around that time, obviously the leaders in the various regions of Yugoslavia were like, okay, right, we need to start thinking about life after Tito. But then he suddenly dies on the 4th of May, 1980 at a medical center in Ljubljana in Slovenia. So that obviously marks the end of an era in Yugoslav politics. Well, really the era of post-war Yugoslavia. So how does the nation react?
So I think it's, first of all, important to mention that, as we said, the country was a federation of six republics. But with the constitution of 1974, we had also two kind of autonomous regions inside Serbia. And Tito, of course, was at the head of the state, but he never kind of permitted nor nominated like an heir who would succeed him, like an individual who will continue his path, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
When he died, as you said, in Ljubljana,
which was probably a big mistake, really.
I would say so, yeah. It's interesting that when he died on, as you said, May the 4th in Ljubljana, there was a huge match that was played in Belgrade, the football match, like probably the biggest, one of the biggest matches and biggest derbies on Maracana. That's the name of the stadium. And it was played between Red Star from Belgrade and Hajduk from Split, from today's Croatia. Mm-hmm. And when they've announced that Tito died, literally everyone, and it's like 60,000-70,000 people, because it's a huge stadium, everyone started crying. And even the players, and they started embracing themselves, and they started, you know, I don't know, obviously talking about the importance of Tito, etc. And I recall that on the top of one of the newspapers that I read before, when I was going through some archive, someone said, "We all cried, but we did not know we were also burying Yugoslavia." So they thought, of course, they were crying because Tito died, but they didn't realize actually that with Tito's death, Yugoslavia has died as well.
Okay, interesting. So yeah, Tito's death triggers, you know, obviously a period of national mourning in Yugoslavia. People are devastated. The country comes to a standstill and you have a huge state funeral, obviously. So, you know, all this mourning.
Actually, it is the biggest public funeral of a state's leader that was visited by hundreds and hundreds of politicians from all around the world, statesmen.
Wow. And I mean, you know, that shows you his reach and how well he was respected.
That helps, that both from the West and from the East.
Shows you how well he was respected. But obviously, behind this sadness, the leaders in Yugoslavia are like, fuck, what do we do now? So there is a very uncertain future. There's a power vacuum. And yeah, they're essentially not really sure what to do. And I guess you could say this was really the beginning of the end. The end of Tito was the beginning of the end of Yugoslavia.
Absolutely. It was a complete chaos. As we said, we didn't have an individual that was to succeed him. So what they did, they created this kind of presidency where we had six representatives from all the republics. And yeah, there was always like a kind of head of presidency, but they were kind of taking turns. And as you can imagine, there is a huge economic crisis in the 1980s. People were unsatisfied. There is also, a rise of nationalism.
Right.
A huge one, especially in the late 1980s.
And also because the 1974 constitution granted a lot more autonomy to the various states. So I think that's when they really started to enforce that autonomy.
Yeah, yeah. especially the situation with Kosovo and Vojvodina, which had an autonomous status inside of Republic of Serbia. Right. And some historians would say that the Yugoslav crisis began in Kosovo, and it will unfortunately end in Kosovo, although we can actually say that the situation in that region is still pretty unstable, as we are all aware of it. So
right.
definitely the 1980s, the last decades, I would say, of the whole century, kind of marked the huge downfall of Yugoslavia.
So Tito dies in 1980. He's really the linchpin that has been holding Yugoslavia together. That linchpin is gone. Everything starts falling apart over the 1980s. And really by the early 90s, especially with the Croatian-Slovenian declarations of independence, that's really when Yugoslavia is thought to have ceased to exist. And then, of course, obviously you have the horrors over the course of the 90s. We'll save that for another episode because it's obviously very interesting and it's tragic and it's got a lot to delve into. But now, finally, I want to turn to Tito's legacy. So how, as you, as a Southern Slav who, you know, lived, who is from a country that used to be part of Yugoslavia, of Tito's Yugoslavia, how personally would you say he is remembered?
Well, a complex question, definitely.
Yeah, and it's hard definitely nuanced, like all of these things.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but this is really like, you know, the way how we are remembering someone and the way how that specific figure, it doesn't matter whether it's Tito or someone else, being portrayed in media, in textbooks, et cetera, in different, even decades, I would say, is a different story as well. I know that a couple of years ago, there was they've tried to kind of evaluate in all the countries, I would say, of former Yugoslavia. I know that was definitely a case in Montenegro, how important some historical figures are in general and who, in the opinion of young people, for example, are the most known, the most important political figures in history. I know that in most of the republics, Tito was always somewhere at the top of the list.
Right.
Either number one, number two, or number three.
Am I right in thinking that young people still look up to him?
Mostly.
Right.
Unfortunately, it's a black and white approach. So either you believe
you either
that
hate him or you love him.
Yes.
Right.
And unfortunately, most of the people, not only regarding Tito, but most of these events that we have mentioned, including the wars in the 90s, have that black and white perspective. People right. are not like we were today. Okay, let's talk about the good and the bad sides. And let's try later on to see what the score is. Like, are the good things are waiting the bad ones?
It's very much he was either this or he was either that. A lot of people, I think, don't really seem to be able to see the sort of nuance in between. I mean, I think, obviously, to wrap it up, I mean, his positive aspects, you know, unification and stability, resistance to fascism, the non-alignment movement, which I think was really his crowning achievement, really, economic development, and obviously, you know, various, you know, liberal cultural and social policies. But of course, you know, you still had negative aspects like the authoritarian rule, political repression, the, as you said, the Informbüro period and purges from 1948 to 1953. You know, you did still have censorship and, you know, lack of political freedoms, economic issues, legacy of suppression. So, you know, people experienced Tito's rule in different ways. Obviously, there were plenty of people who experienced it in a very negative way. And it's important to stress that, you know, we're not trying to say that that is not valid, because obviously people did have very negative experiences as well. But at the end of the day, Tito was human, you know, and that's, you know, he is a human who had flaws. But, you know, I think what I just find fascinating about Tito is that, from what I can tell anyway, is he's really the only instance of a dictator that really, I would say, most people from that part of the world that I meet do talk about, if not, you know, actively supporting him, you know, think of him fondly, you know, almost like the sort of the father of the nation.
Yeah, I would agree in a way, because I think that he, in a way, Titoism is a form of religion, or has become a form of religion in some parts of like Yugoslavia. And people definitely, you know, are referring to him as a father, in a way, of that whole political doctrine and ideology that we have mentioned today.
Yes, exactly. Well, anyway, Igor, that was a really, really, really fascinating discussion. Thank you so, so, so much for it. It was really, really enlightening. Tito is really a fascinating person, and I can't really wait to read up more about him, really, because he really, really, really was very in my opinion, one of history's most fascinating figures. But yeah, we should probably wrap it up there. So, okay, Igor, well, thank you very much. And thank you to everyone listening. I hope you found this episode enlightening about Josip Broz Tito. And yes, join us again very soon. And yeah, thank you very much for listening. Goodbye. Hi guys, just a quick heads up. This episode was shortened to fit within the time limit. If you'd like to catch the full length version and even watch the video, head over to the History Buff Patreon page. Your support means the world to me. Until next time, take care and stay tuned for more exclusive content on Patreon. Cheers.